Okay, I'd like to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that time is currently 1:38 p.m. on Thursday, February 6th, 2020. Today, we've got present Representative LeBon, Representative Tilton, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Johnston, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool. Representative Merrick, I believe you're online. Are you there?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great, thank you. And myself, Co-Chair Foster, just a reminder, if folks could please mute their cell phones. I'd also like to point out that we've got two birthdays in the House. One was yesterday, one is tomorrow. And so we're splitting the difference. And there are two of our staff. Jody's birthday was yesterday, and Helen's birthday is tomorrow. So if you get a chance, please wish them a happy birthday. Thank you. And so today we will hear two budget overview presentations, one from the Department of Corrections and the second from the Department of Public Safety. And we're hoping to spend an hour on corrections and then the second hour on public safety. So with that, if we could have Acting Deputy Commissioner Jennifer Winkleman, Admin Services Director April Wilkerson, and Special Assistant to the Commissioner, Kelly Howell, come up to the table. And if you could put yourselves on the record. And let's see, Commissioner Nancy Dahlstrom, are you also online?
I am.
Great, thank you. Okay, so since we do have multiple voices, if you could just, if there's a lot of back and forth, if you could just identify yourselves, it'll help with transcription later. So with that, if you could put yourself on the record.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. It's really nice to be in front of you. This is Nancy Dahlstrom, for the record, Commissioner, Department of Corrections. And I believe that you have our presentation. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. So you know that our department is essential in enhancing the safety of our communities. And our goal is what we do is provide secure confinement. We offer programs to help folks so that they're better when they come out than when they come in. And we also have a process of supervised community reintegration. There's a structural chart that's there that you can see how we kind of break down in my office. And then on slide three, Alaska is one of seven, and I'm going to tell you that the handout says six. That was an error on our part. There are seven states in the nation that operate a unified correctional system. In addition to the ones that are listed here, West Virginia became a unified state in July of 2018. And a unified system is one where it's integrated state and the local level prison and jail system. On slide four, it kind of gives you some of our statistics. In 2019, we booked over 33,000 offenders. About 1,600 of them were non-criminal Title 47s, and those bring special challenges for our officers and the HARS department also. As of 1/24 in 2020, so far we've been responsible for 10,986 individuals. And you will see the breakdown on how they are. And one thing I'd like to point out, and we've talked about it before, is 51% of these offenders are unsentenced. And then we have the offenders that are on pretrial, probation, and parole. We have folks in community residential centers, which we refer to as CRCs, and almost 1,200 folks that are on electronic monitoring, or we refer to that as EM. On slide five, April, if you could go over this, please.
And if you could put yourself on the record.
Thank you. Thank you. For the record, my name is April Wilkerson, and I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections. Slide five is the projection of the offender population, as well as the actual counts. The projection on the orange line is the population projections that were anticipated under House Bill 49 that was passed last year. The blue line is what the department has actually incurred as of July of 2019. And you can see that those two lines intersect right around the February-March timeframe. And then it is projected to continue to be on par with the projections from the fiscal note last year.
And then, April, if you could take slide seven, or excuse me, eight and nine also, please. Seven and eight.
On slide six, what we have done with this slide is we have taken the same population projections and we have broken them out by the unsentenced population versus the sentenced population, and showing that this fiscal year is the increase in the unsentenced population now exceeds the population that is held within our institutions over the sentenced population. On slide seven, this is the projected same population going forward through the December of 2020 by legal status. So you can see the fluctuations between the unsentenced population and the sentenced population going back and forth. Slide eight is our overall budget comparison. We're looking at FY19, where the department's budget was $332 million versus FY21, where we are requesting $404 million, $739,000. It is an overall increase of 21.6%. That is a 20% increase of over FY19 of our general funds. The overall increase from FY20 is a 7% increase, or a $25 million difference. The primary drivers in the Department of Corrections budget are related to House Bill 49. There are some federal grants that have been received, as well as the increase in the physical health care and the associated cost with the medical for the prison population.
Got a question, Representative Wool, and then Johnston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair. We talk about the increase due to HB 49. Is there an increase, or do you know, or can you quantify, due to HB, I think it was 54 that we spoke about, where someone who's sentenced, I mean, awaiting sentence is released, and then if they violate condition of release, they're go back to jail. Is that population gone up? And if so, how is that contributing to your 51% of unsentenced?
Through the chair to Representative Wool, I wouldn't say just Senate Bill 54 increased our population. There has been several pieces of legislation that overall has changed the driving trend of the population. When Senate Bill 91 passed, there was this continual decline in the incarcerated population, and that trend has leveled out and is increasing. So I think the answer is that it is incorporated into the populations that are in front of you.
Follow up. Just to clarify, so the increase in unsentenced that you're in your custody has gone up for many reasons, but also HB 54, which changed how people, the conditions on which they're released and the violation of those conditions has brought them back into custody. Is that fair to say?
For the record, this is Jen Winkleman, Acting Deputy Commissioner, and yes, that would be a fair, anecdotally, I would have to get offline and get stats for you.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Representative Johnston and then Josephson. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, part of that relative to the parolees, and probationers is we repealed the 3, 5, and 10 day rule and went back to not the pre-91 rule, but it was like a 30, 60, and 90 day rule or something. In other words, people who are dinged with a petition to revoke are they're spending more time in custody. Is that right?
Through the chair to Rep. Justice, We did repeal the 3.5.10 with regard to technical violations. However, we left in the administrative sanctions, and I don't have the exact numbers, so I don't want to state anything on the record. I would say that folks are still serving a period of time, but it isn't to the, we're not seeing the trends of the 30, 60, 90 that you're talking about. But I would have to get that answer for you offline.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, to the chair. I'm looking at slide six, where the sentenced population has almost somewhat declined, and of course the unsentenced has gone up. Is there a difference in cost between the unsentenced and the sentenced? I would think the unsentenced would, are you including ones that are on electronic monitoring, or is it all just the ones that are in jail waiting to be sentenced versus the ones in prison?
Through the chair to Representative Johnston, this is only the incarcerated population, so only someone that is actually taking up a hard bed. We do not separate out the cost for between sentenced versus unsentenced because we co-mingle that population for housing purposes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, this is Nancy Dahlstrom, if I might.
Commissioner?
Answer that. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Johnson, one of the factors that is important in the unsentenced population versus sentenced is that we need to keep unsentenced folks on the road system and relatively close to courthouses or places where their attorneys can have access to them. So it does limit where we can place them. Also, the officers all say that the unsentenced versus sentenced population acts totally different. Once they're sentenced, kind of settle down and say, okay, this is what we're doing, and hopefully make the best of it. But unsentenced often feels they'll go to the judge and then they're just going to be out.
Thank you.
Representative Wu.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and through the chair. This graph here goes back to January of 19, and you have another graph that goes forward. Do you have a graph that goes back a bunch, so you can look at a trend over, you know, 5 or 10 years as far as unsentenced versus sentenced? Probably not in this slide deck today, but I'm just curious how it's changed.
Through the chair to Representative Wool, we can provide that to you.
Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Looking on your page 8 with your significant changes, is there somewhere further in the presentation that attributes a dollar amount to those changes, or a percentage of the increase or decrease or whatever to those changes?
Through the chair to Representative Tilton, I believe that you'll see those later on in the slide.
Okay, thank you.
Just real quickly.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you know, is there information out there available that would compare the percentages of our population being unsentenced versus sentenced and how they compare to other states? I'm not sure that that's relevant necessarily, but I wonder if that's out there.
For the record, this is Jen Winkleman.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, this is Nancy Dahlstrom. Representative Ortiz, I personally don't have any comparison on that. Jen, you started to interject. Why don't you finish your statement?
For the record, this is Jen Winkleman. Through the chair to Representative Ortiz, I don't either. But there has to be something out there, and I certainly would like to look into it for you. Somebody else, maybe in subcommittee, had asked about the same Representative Carpenter. So we will see what we can find.
I just asked.
Representative Ortiz.
And I am not on the subcommittee, so therefore not quite as familiar with some of these terms. Can you just tell me pretrial, what makes up the unsentenced population? In other words, that number? What goes into that number?
Sure. Through the chair to Representative Ortiz, folks that are have not been convicted.
Okay. So it's simply pretrial.
Pretrial, yeah. Yep.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you. I've got a question with regard to the budget on page 8. Then, as we're looking at DGF, I see with the FY20 management plan that it's 35 million, but then for the governor's request, it's down to 13.9 million. Why is there a difference in that, and what are we seeing that's different for DGF?
Through the chair to Representative Sullivan Leonard, there was some fund source changes. So the Power Cost Equalization Fund was part of the designated general funds, which has been either reduced or moved over into the UGF column. There's also the change from the other fund source, which was the another fund change from the recidivism reduction or the restorative justice fund. Reducing that amount that was appropriated and replacing it with general funds within the health and rehabilitation component.
Okay, thank you.
Please continue.
Slide 9 is a breakout of the overall FY21 budget request by fund source. It also represents the 25.6 million of the other that has been identified as duplicated funds, so they're housed in two places within the budget. The Department of Corrections budget on slide 10 is broken out by our fund sources. It is the agency with the fifth largest budget out of the agencies, and it is also the third largest UGF budget within the governor's request. Slide 11 is broken out by the line items. Personal services is just over 56% with our services, which is our contracts, utilities, and so on and so forth, at 36%. We do have a small maintenance and renovation budget of about $1 million, which is within our capital outlay. Our budget is broken out into three core service areas with secure confinement, supervised release, and the reformative programming. 80% of the budget is allocated specifically for secure confinement, and that does include the medical budget. Supervised release is all-encompassing of those individuals that are supervised within the community. And then our reformative programs are the programs available throughout the institutions. Slide 13 is a comparison between the FY20 management plan by those core services to the 21 governor's request that does reflect the $25 million increase, or the 7%. Commissioner?
Yes.
Do you want to take slides 14?
Oh, there was a blip. Yes, I'd be happy to. For the record, this is Commissioner Nancy Dahlstrom. On slide 14, we talk about different resources that we have within the department. We obviously have the director's office, and there's 12 in-state correctional centers. We have a classification and furlough unit, inmate transportation. I mean, you all can read very well, so I don't need to read this to you, but if you have questions on any of those specific areas, we can answer them. Slide 15 shows you the areas around the state that we have facilities that are for secure confinement. 12 of those are state institutions, and 15 of those are regional and community jails. On slide 16, our core reformative services include health and rehab, behavioral health care. We have substance abuse treatment programs, sex offender management programs, education programs, voc ed programs, the domestic violence, and faith-based services. We have increased our recidivism reduction with these programs, and we have reentry services, and then, of course, the full admin and support that goes along with all of those areas.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does Commissioner Dahlstrom, does the having access to those different programs vary quite a bit depending on where you are located within the state system?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, good question. In the past, they have varied, and I will tell you that we don't have every single program at every institution. Sometimes it's because we don't have providers in that area. But what we are working on and have almost completed is having the core programs available in every area. Some of these programs like faith-based services and things like that are done by volunteers. And so as you can imagine, they are, you know, they're a stronger program in some areas than others.
Thank you.
Slide 17, this is what is happening in supervised release. Jen at the table is, her area is responsible for the pretrial, probation, and the parole office. And this is statewide. And she also manages community residential centers and the electronic monitoring, admin and support. And then, of course, we have our Correctional Academy, which is in Palmer, and the Parole Board, which is listed under our department, but is really under the governor's office. Slide 18 shows the 13 pretrial and probation offices, the 6 community residential centers, and the 6 electronic monitoring areas.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We hear about the population of people in custody and the numbers. And do you have a graph for the supervised release population, you know, over time? And we understand, the in-house custody has gone up recently. Supervised release, has that also been going up? Not just in the last year.
Representative Wool, I will tell you that it has gone up, but if I could defer to Jen Winkleman on that.
Through the chair, this is Jen Winkleman for the record. Through the chair to Representative Wool, I will do the same thing as we're doing with the population to get some sort of a graph backwards so that you're able to see.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I know nationally there's also a trend for a lot more supervised release. Thank you.
Okay, so on slide 19, this talks about our changing inmate population. April, if you would like to talk about the dollars related to the different items.
For the record, this is April Wilkerson. The overall budget request for the FY21 budget is just over $18 million. That is primarily related to the second year fiscal notes from House Bill 14, as well as the second year fiscal notes of House Bill 49, along with the reversal of the first year one-time item funding that was allocated in the FY20 budget. There's also a structure change request to move the community residential center and the electronic monitoring components back into population management. That would just give the department more flexibility as the population flows from intake to transition to release over to the supervision.
Representative Josephson.
On page 19, can someone tell me I looked in the other pages and didn't see it, the population management component, or RDU, RDU meaning a separate appropriation, correct?
Yes. Through the chair to Representative Josephson.
My question is, what is the total that was appropriated in FY20 for population management?
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, I don't have the actual total right now. We can get that to you.
On slide 20, we talk about our recruitment efforts, and the request is for $136,000 to expand our recruitment outreach. This includes developing recruitment strategies and we're looking at different populations that we can target and how we can do that better. We've also increased our advertising on websites and identified markets where the advertising is more effective than others, on top of attending recruitment fairs statewide. And we are also advertising not only statewide, but out of state. For our secure and safe institutions, there's a request of $668,000. This is to add one new drug dog, which would assist us in combating contraband. You know that is a challenge that we deal with on a regular basis. The dogs are used for searches, sometimes in the building, sometimes in the parking lot. Currently, we have one. His name is Coda, and he does an incredible job, very, very beneficial to us. But they also attend and all the events, visitor events, and they screen cars coming in. They are there at the facility, kind of going around while the events are going on. And as long as, officers who are always on the watch for the contraband.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, through the chair. Commissioner Dahlstrom, I just wanted to ask a quick question with regard to the drug dog that you're looking to have active in our facilities. Some of the information I have received is that the transference of drugs coming into the prisons, the facilities, are such that it's difficult to see them. It's difficult to actually pinpoint exactly where they are. So is that part of the challenge that you face, that probably the drug dog can actually sense exactly where the particular drugs are hidden, whether it's on a person or outfit or whatever the mode of transportation is for the drugs? Is that the point? And then what is the success rate then for the drug dogs?
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, it is correct. The dog can pick up scents that nobody else might be able to. I can't give you statistics on how much more we are getting than before, because I would be foolish to believe that we caught absolutely everything, even though we are attempting to. We've made a request also for body scanners that will increase our ability to see what one might have internally on their body. Currently, we have scanners that will show metal only, but they don't show a mass or plastic or different things. And I will just tell you that the inmates can be very creative on where they put these things to bring them in.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner, this is Representative Johnston. At one point I saw that there was going to be a process in which inmate mail would be part of the security and the drug defense. Is that now off the table? I was looking here and I didn't see. I'm not weighing in one way or the other, but.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, unless we have different sides, I see it on the bottom of page 20. Is it on yours?
Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay.
I didn't read all the way
question.
Through.
We are requesting $400,000 to have additional staff, not officers, that would be helping us to copy mail, and the inmates would then receive the photocopy of their mail. And the only actual copies that come to us would be the legal mail. We get the inmates their mail within 24 hours of receiving it, and that would still be our goal, that we would do that. But again, the inmates can be very creative on how drugs and other contraband are inserted into mail, and you don't see it. It's not something that the naked eye is going to pick up.
And a follow-up to this, has this been something that's been tried in other facilities, and does it prove to be effective?
Representative Johnson, there was a test done at Goose Creek a few years ago that did prove to be effective. It was successful. I not being in the department, then I can't speak to, you know, why it wasn't put into effect full time. I do know I've spoken with commissioners from other states who use that program, and they feel that it is very effective.
Hey, thank you. Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And you actually asked one of the questions I was going to pose regarding the mail. And maybe you can educate me about computer access and email. Is it just a zero opportunity? Is it limited? Or how would email play into this?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative LeBon. I think that you, if you haven't already seen, you will soon be receiving a request from us in the form of a bill to introduce tablets for our inmates. And these are things that they would be able to get some of their education classes on. They could have some of their treatment on. We may be, depending on what we decide on, we may be able to have photos on them. But as far as actual internet in the institutions, we do not have that. It's not safe.
Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So sitting on the Corrections Subcommittee, a couple of these questions were asked, and I thought some pertinent information. One, I'd asked a question of DOC to maybe talk about or think about consolidating the mail services. Instead of having to deal with mail at multiple institutions, maybe they can consolidate it. And they said they'd get back to me, but there's no definitive, unless something's changed in the 24 or 48 hours. The other piece of this, too, from the dog's point of view, dogs are effective, but they're only effective for a short period of time. And that's the other, they can't work 8 hours. They're like a 2 hours or something. So that's the other impact here, is that a dog's not going to work for a whole day.
So through the chair, Representative Carpenter, you are absolutely correct on the dog. And depending on how extensively their drug training is, sometimes they work for 20 minutes and then they take a break. Sometimes it might be 30 minutes and then they take a break. It depends on the scent and the situation, which that's their handler, you know, knows what that is. But no, they don't work for a straight 8 hours. And concerning the consolidation, I will tell you that since the subcommittee meeting we had internally, we have discussed that and we have been looking at different things and ways, you know, could we do this? What location would we do it at? How much time would it take us to then get the mail to the facilities? So even though I don't have an answer for you on that today, we are working on it.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess two questions related to this. You said it was tried at Goose Creek and it was successful, the photocopying of the mail. How do you measure its success unless you then afterwards test all the mail via dog or other technical means to see if there was drugs in the mail that you photocopied? In other words, how do you measure success on a program like this?
Through the chair, Representative Wall, that's a good question. Inmates are subject to random UAs, and when we give a UA after or ask inmates to take UAs after special events that have been held there, or if somebody is obviously under the influence, I mean, we see a spike after certain things, and we see, you know, a lull other times. So that's a big part of it.
Thank you. And follow up. Representative LeBon, I believe someone mentioned email, which if you want to reduce the amount of contraband coming in through mail, email seems like a logical way. I know inmates can make phone calls at a pretty good rate of charge. But is there do any other states just use like a sort of universal terminal that can people can put emails in and not necessarily connect to the internet, but stack up some emails and then they all get sent out at one time a day? And then is there any sort of email account system that other states have used that would certainly eliminate a lot of this mail contraband issue?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, I do know that there are some programs. I do not have cost estimates on that, but again, we've been talking about that, and you're correct. It wouldn't be wise to have live internet there because we are all extremely aware of and know what our responsibility is to protect the victims, and so we cannot allow any possible communication from the institution to the, you know, inappropriate folks. I will tell you that we have looked into terminals, and it kind of follows along with the tablet that we have talked about and you're going to hear more about in the future.
Thank you.
Please continue.
So on slide 21, this is about our recidivism reduction. We're requesting $1.8 million, and this is to establish and bolster our reentry efforts now. We'll create a new reentry unit component, which is just specifically on reentry. And we all know it's extremely important for the human intervention and the different services. On top of the fact that the person is, serving out their punishment. But if they just serve the punishment and leave, they most likely won't be better when they go out than when they came in. So we put great value on the recidivism efforts and would like to continue and also improve on that. We do look at federal grant opportunities on a regular basis, and we currently have a few that are very beneficial to us. On page 22, April, would you like to take this, please?
For the record, this is April Wilkerson again. On slide 22 is a representation of the Division of Institutions. The overall budget is $271 million of the department's $404 million ask. Secure confinement is our largest division within the Department of Corrections budget, and it is broken up into various funding sources, including designated general funds that are received through mandate billings for housing offenders that are held on a local or municipal hold. Additionally, there is $13 million in interagency receipts that are included in that agency's budget. And then the federal funding within this division is just over $11.9 million. And that is funding and authorization to for revenues that are received from the mandate billings of the federal holds within that division. And there is 1,378 employees that are identified within that secure.
Representative Josephson?
Yes, through the chair. I had asked earlier about population management, and what I'm am curious about is the separate appropriation of the money for the Palmer Correctional Center, which was in the range of $16 million. If you can't access that unless the center is open, and I know that that's soon to happen, then you must be short. By my reckoning, that is, you must need desperately that $16 million. So I'm just trying to figure out if I'm right about that, or if you didn't need it to cover the other facilities.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair to Representative Josephson, there is actually I believe it's $14.8 million increment request that's included in the institution director's office. There's also in the supplemental request, we are asking for a term date extension on the current $16.6 million for the Palmer reopening. So what that does is that gives us the flexibility and the ability to utilize the Palmer money to get that facility open, operational, as well as the $14 million that's within the institution director's office to house those individuals until the Palmer facility is open.
April, if you could take the next, please.
On slide 23, our second largest division within the DOC budget is the Health and Rehabilitation Reformative Program Division. That includes the physical health care and the medical expenses, as well as all of the reformative programmings that are within the department's budget. It does reflect the reentry and recidivism unit. That is does include the $700,000 that is being asked for the new reentry unit. On slide 24 is the Division of Pretrial Probation and Parole. That the department did successfully combine the Division of Pretrial into Probation and Parole under Director Winkleman. And so that is one of the successes that was able to be achieved that expands the efficiencies and the effectiveness of that division. It is primarily general funds, and they supervise quite those individuals that are within the communities. There's 234 staff that are assigned to that statewide. They do have a small amount of federal authority that they utilize through the equitable sharing program that they participate in with the federal government.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Of those 234 positions, how many are filled right now? Or unfilled, I guess.
For the record, this is Jen Winkleman, through the chair to Representative Wall. Approximately 40 positions are vacant right now.
Okay, so about 1/6.
I should say approximately 40 probation officer vacancies exist right now, and I would have to look up to get you administrative support how many, what that number would look like.
Thank you.
But comparing it to the 234, I'm not positive on record, but I can get that for you.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chair, this is Nancy Dahlstrom. Representative Wall, I would also like to point out that pretrial is relatively new, and a year ago we didn't even know if this was going to still be existing, and we do know that a lot of people didn't apply for it because they thought it was going to be gone. So I foresee that those employment numbers are going to be going up.
Follow up? So does this go back to our discussion of supervised pretrial population that didn't in fact used to exist, but with HB 54, I hope I'm getting my numbers right, that's what started this type of population?
Jen, can you take that, please?
Through the chair to Representative Wall, through SB 91, the pretrial division, pretrial enforcement
91.
Division
was
established, and yes, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, 91.
Commissioner, this is Representative Johnston again, and actually I was looking through here to see if we had vacancies throughout this report, so I would like to have that for each of the departments.
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, we can absolutely get you that.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Just to follow up on Representative Wool's question, the supervised release unit, that's something that survived the repeal effort in House Bill 49, correct?
Through the chair to Representative Justin, yes, correct.
Slide 25 is the Board of Parole. They oversee all of the parole releases from the incarcerated population. They are general funds at $1.8 million. There is a dedicated staff, plus there are five board members that are appointed by the governor's office. It is a quasi-judicial branch that is just housed within the Department of Corrections. They really operate in an autonomous fashion. The Office of the Commissioner is on slide 26. That's $2.5 million. That does include the Commissioner's Office and the Training Academy. The Department of Corrections does offer and operate a basic training academy that oversees all of the training and the basic training requirements of our correctional and our probation officer throughout the department. There's 18 dedicated staffs within that division or within that office, with 8 of those being dedicated to the training academy. On slide 27 is the Division of Administrative Services. That budget is almost $10.4 million, with just under $150,000 of federal authority. So it is primarily general funds with 52 budgeted positions. And that does incorporate the facility capital improvement unit as well as research and records. And then we also oversee the Alaska Corrections Offender Management System. That is an in-house system that is maintained and operated.
Mr. Chair, on slide 28, again, you can all read very well, so a lot of this is repetitive, but these are our goals, obviously protect the public. And I might add, I'm very concerned about always keeping the inmates safe inside also, providing the safe and secure care. We want to reduce the prison population in any way that we can help. We would like to reduce recidivism. And we would like to ensure that our offenders who are in our custody spend productive time as much as possible. I would like to note for the record that we can provide programs, which we do, and if an inmate is not interested or not willing or absolutely refuses to participate, that is their choice. So we can't force anyone in the program, but we try to make them interesting and exciting enough, and even sometimes incentives for them to participate because of the good that will come from there. We are also working collaboratively with outside stakeholders, and those are the different, different reentry coalitions and things that are around. We appreciate and respect very much what they do. And at that point, I would tell you that we are open for any questions that you might have.
Representative Laban.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, thank you for this report and for your staff. Thank you for being with us. Last session, we spent quite a bit of time on ankle monitoring and electronic monitoring and trying to find a way to manage folks that are in pretrial without putting them in an institution. Do you have any new words about that concept and where it might be today versus 6 months ago?
Through the chair, Representative Laban, I will tell you that our numbers for EM clients have increased, but I'd like to defer to Jen Winkleman, who manages that area, for a more exact answer.
Through the chair to Representative Laban. We have electronic monitoring for the pretrial enforcement division, so we have folks out on that. In regards to the sentenced electronic monitoring, a couple slides back we talked about we're moving our electronic monitoring and our the CRCs, our halfway houses, under the population management so that it can all be managed, and we're constantly looking at folks that are in custody to move them to electronic monitoring or to a halfway house or reentry type housing so they're not in a bed. As far as an unsentenced population on EM, those will run through the pretrial enforcement division.
Representative. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Laban, I would also like to add that it's probably most people don't know this, but there are some inmates who are eligible to go to the CRCs or the halfway houses, and they choose not to. They prefer to stay in jail and flatline on their time because they can choose not to do anything but wait out their time there. Once they go to the community residential centers, there are expectations of them and classes and different things that they need to participate in. And some folks, unfortunately, would just rather sit and wait their time out.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I want to say it's not a quick question. We're looking at having to open up a prison, an increasing trend of population since criminal reform happened last year. I don't expect that trend can continue to increase forever, just based on statistically, at some point in time, you capture most of the criminals. U.S. population, is the research that I've done, is about 700 per 100,000. So that puts a 4,600 number of incarcerated inmates as kind of where we might be with the size of population. I was just curious, since you guys are the subject matter experts here, do you see the population of the prisons continuing to increase and the subsequent costs that we need to be prepared for, or is it a, are we going to peak out here at some point in time? I'm just curious what the kind of the industry thinks.
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I think that in our state we will see an increase for the next several years, and I hope that we peak out. But I do believe that we're going to see an increase, and I'm going to bring this subject up before any of you ask. As you know, I have stated that we are going to bring Palmer online, and the status on that right now is that there's a feasibility study that's being completed. We should have that draft next week, and that's just something that legally we're required to do as part of the process. We are working with DOT, who will be running the project. We are having planning meetings with them, and we are issuing an RSA of $400,000 for them to design, and all the inspections that will have to go along for the DOT engineers for this facility. And different dates have been given for opening. All the building type people say 12 to 18 months, but my commitment to you and to everyone is that we are going to do everything we can to get it going so it can operate safely as soon as possible.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess on that point, we heard 12 to 18 months, DOT is getting involved, inspections and engineers, and it sounds a little bit cumbersome and laborious, and I hope it can go faster than that. I'm going to draw a comparison that really has no relevance, but I just have to say it anyways. There's the coronavirus epidemic in China, and they built a 1,000-bed hospital in 10 days. I know that's apples to coconuts, but that being said, I would think if there's a will to open up a portion of Palmer in staged, you know, and maybe not get everything on your wish list done before the first person arrives there, but, you know, to stage an opening and open a section and relieve some of the pressure on the rest of the institutions. And it's been said that you guys are at 97% capacity. However, that's max capacity, and that means, sure, you can handle a few more percentage of people, which you're doing right now. But initially, when the institutions were built, they were designed for less, and that's why certain institutions have beds in the gyms. For years and years and years and years, there's been beds in gyms. So my question is, what percent capacity are you at standard capacity, not max capacity? I'm assuming it's over. I know it's over 100. Do you have that number, Commissioner, or anyone else?
I don't have it on hand. It would be different for each facility. But as you mentioned, there are facilities that there are beds in gyms. There are facilities where traditionally maybe there's been one bunk, but now there's two. We've done what we can safely do to house them. As far as the timeline for Palmer, I will do everything I can do to accelerate it. The reason we are working with DOT is because that's the state process, and that's how we are required to work with them through the procurement process. But I believe that they'll be effective partners with us, and anything we can do to speed this up will be done. As far as opening up part of the facility, if we can do that safely, I am very open to looking at that. I can't give you a definite on that now because there's so many parts of that, like the electrical and the alarm system and the cameras and everything that goes through the entire facility, it would all need to be done in order for it to work in that one part that we opened up. But please know that I am open to that if it's a possibility, and will always be looking for that.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Way back on page 4, there was the figure of 1,601 non-criminal Title 47 bookings. And I know this is sort of the intersection of DHSS and your department. And I also recall that it was the end of the Walker term that this issue began to be highlighted. But can you, can any of you tell me what the, what you've learned about the law, that is, the requirements on those bookings? Are we following court orders? Are we waiting for more DHS facilities to open up? Just anything you could share with me about the nature of that and what we can expect in the future.
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, we do have Laura Brooks, our division operations manager for our health and rehabilitative services, in the room, and so perhaps she could come up to the table and answer that question.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Laura Brooks, division operations manager for the Division of Health and Rehabilitative Services. So through the chair to Representative Josephson, what I can tell you is we are operating under the letter of the law, which says if there's an individual who needs to be taken into protective custody while they're waiting for a bed at API, they can be held at a correctional facility. And that 1,601 number that you see, that's not all of those who have been waiting for a bed at API. That also includes our Title 47 holds that are there on an alcohol hold, which is very different. Those alcohol holds are for individuals who can be held in a correctional facility up to 12 hours while they're waiting for them to become sober, waiting for another placement at either home or a treatment facility. So the number that have been awaiting beds at API is roughly about 150 since API went on divert in October of 2018. We've had about 150 or 160 of those individuals held in our system.
And Mr. Chair, I would like to tell you and the committee that the officers and the medical folks in all of these institutions have done just an admirable job with the Title 12 and Title 47s. They all need some sort of a special attention, or it's not just a regular situation in there, but the officers do just a wonderful job with rising to the occasion on, you know, each individual situation. Medical oftentimes has to deal with things that they don't normally deal with, but we do everything we can to keep them safe and secure.
Follow up?
Yeah, just to repeat that. So the API divert is where API said this isn't working and they reduced their numbers or they lacked certificate or whatever it was, but they started to reduce the number of beds. And you said the number that were coming into your facilities was, what, 100 to 150 during some period?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, the number since API officially notified that they were having to reduce their beds, the number since that time, and I believe that was October 6th of 2018, I think that was about the date, the number that we've taken in that we can track as part of that has been about 150 to 160 individuals.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, since this page is up, I'm just noticing on the bottom of you have 1,122 offenders on electronic monitoring. Of those, 985 are in pretrial. So can I conclude that 137 are offenders that are post-pretrial that are on electronic monitoring? Of your whole population, that means only 137 are on electronic monitoring right now?
Through the chair to Representative, well, yes, that's the approximate number point in time on that date for sentenced population. And it also captures a lot of the sentenced population that will go on to electronic monitoring may only have to do, say, a three-day sentence for a DUI. And so depending on where this, what the day of the count is, the average, I think it, with that, you know, in the 130s, maybe up to 160, something like that.
Follow up.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So you have 4,800 offenders on, well, you combine pretrial, probation, and parole, so that's, I guess, of the thousands of people that are in your custody, not on pretrial, I guess I thought there was a push to put more people on EM, and it looks like there's 100 and something, which out of all your people on It seems like a low number, I guess, especially since there's a push towards that. Is that, am I misinterpreting the numbers?
Through the chair, Representative, well, you're not misinterpreting the numbers. That it, what we are doing now, as I noted a little bit, I think was Rep. LeBon's question, moving electronic monitoring under the population management, so under the authority of the institutions, essentially, for lack of a better way to say it, so that they're monitoring, taking a look at the sentenced population and being able to move them where they are in the least restrictive housing possible. So if they're eligible for electronic monitoring, they're moving them toward the electronic monitoring placement versus folks having to apply and go through a process to get on, using it to push electronic monitoring numbers for those that are eligible for the program.
Thank you.
Comment on that.
Representative Joseph, and just, you know, we are eating into the other budget.
Well, just that we, under House Bill 49, we reduced eligibility. We constrained the categories of felons, at least, that were eligible for EM post-trial, post-sentence.
Through the chair to Representative Justin, I'm not certain that we did.
Any other questions? Thank you. Next we'll have public safety budget overview. I'd like to invite up Amanda Price, Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, and Tori Jacobson, budget analysis for Department of Public Safety. Thank you for both being here, and please identify yourself, be on the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Amanda Price, Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. At your invitation, Madam Chair, I'd also like to invite Colonel Brian Barlow to the table to answer questions as needed.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Tori Jacobson, Budget Manager, Department of Public Safety.
Colonel, would you like to put yourself on the record too, please?
Madam Chair, members of the board, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Brian Barlow, Director of the Alaska State Troopers within the Department of Public Safety.
Thank you. Also present for the pleasure of the committee is Colonel Doug Massey, Director of the Alaska Wildlife Troopers, Captain Rick Roberts, Major Byrne Chastain, Fire Marshal Rich Boothby, Executive Director of the Police Standards Council, Bob Griffiths, the Chief of our State Crime Lab Facility, Dave Canaris, the Executive Director of the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, Diane Casto, and we have some of our troopers from our Southeast Post that are present to participate as well. Thank you all to my team for being present. The mission of the Department of Public Safety is to administer functions relative to the protection of life and property. Our core services include law enforcement patrol and investigations, rural law enforcement services, domestic violence and sexual assault programming, statewide public safety programming, resource protection, and highway safety. Included under the rural law enforcement services is where we find our village public safety officer program housed. The statewide impact is that the Department of Public Safety is Alaska's primary statewide law enforcement agency. In addition to the law enforcement response that the Alaska State Troopers provide, we are also responsible for providing direct support to other agencies, inclusive of investigative assistance, search and rescue, training, managing the Alaska Public Safety Information Network, and the State Crime Lab. At this point, I'd like to ask Tori Jacobson to walk the committee through the financials.
For the record, Tori Jacobson. Between fiscal year 19 and 21, overall the department's budget increased by approximately $34 million. A good portion of that was federal. Some notable items were $5 million in federal receipt authority for the high-intensity drug trafficking area, or HIDA program, $4 million in federal receipt authority to Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault for the Victims of Crime Act grant. There is additional funding for VOCA. Most of the general fund increase was related to personnel, specifically troopers, classification increase in fiscal year 19, salary increase in fiscal year 20. Other funding sources. The change is mostly related to Violent Crimes Compensation Board, which at the time we submitted this budget request, we believed was going to come from Department of Administration over to Public Safety. Changes in designated general fund, about 300, a little over 300,000 was appropriated through a fiscal note to HB 49, came in as power cost equalization. That's being changed to UGF. We also have about $2 million in recidivism reduction funds, which come from marijuana sales taxes. And we also have general fund program receipts from building plan reviews. And if several other sources, and I'm getting into my next slide. Background checks, handgun permits, that's handled in our criminal justice information systems unit. And Alaska police standards, council surcharges on criminal, on citations and criminal convictions.
So just a note on the breakdown by funding source, 59% of our FY21 budget is personal services, 3% is travel, 19% is services, 3% commodity, 1% capital outlay, and 15% grants and benefits. So clearly the majority of the expenditures for the department are personal services related. I'd also like to point, and I believe we'll get to this later in the slides, through between the fiscal years of 18 and 19, we saw an increase of 26% in the overtime hours expended from the department. We are on track to expend an additional 9% and overtime hours due to the staffing shortages that the department is experiencing. The governor's budget reflects measurable outcomes associated with every dollar that we are requesting, though one of the more significant operating budget changes includes improving our building plan review turnaround time in the fire and life safety division. We're asking for 219,000 UGF, which would relate to four permanent full-time positions. The governor's directive is to have the turnaround time for building plan reviews be completed in 2 weeks. This time last year when I sat before this body, we were sitting at between 16 and 18 weeks for a building plan review turnaround time. Right now we are averaging 6 to 8 weeks for plan review turnaround. 2 weeks is our goal. We believe with the addition of these four permanent full-time positions, we will be able to meet that goal of a 2-week turnaround time, which has a direct positive impact to commerce statewide. The next significant line item is the ask to increase our UGF spend for the Alaska State Trooper detachment component. It's $2.733 million. This was also reflected in the supplemental request that the governor put forward for FY20. We are anticipating as a department this fiscal year FY20 running out of funding by mid-April if we do not see the supplemental increase. This is simply rolling the supplemental request that we are asking for into our base operating. This would be the third year in a row that this spend has occurred, FY19 being the first year that a similar dollar amount was expended and needed a supplemental to cover for personal services. That's to maintain existing operations. Our goal is to increase our operational capacity, and we have every plan and intention to do so. This request is, again, to the Alaska State Trooper Detachment line item, 7.599 in UGF. That relates to 36 permanent full-time positions. 15 of those positions are trooper job class. The others are broken out into court service officers, criminal justice techs, and miscellaneous administrative positions. Those civilian positions are critical in allowing troopers to quit doing the administrative work that they are currently doing and allow them to return to the streets and respond to calls for service. The following significant operating budget change is our request to add 7 permanent full-time positions at a rate of about $872,000 for statewide support. This will establish an emergency communication center in Anchorage. This is a topic that I imagine we will have some discussion on, as I've had some discussion with many in this room, and I'm happy to answer any questions that might be presented on that topic.
Representative Cortez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On this particular item, the $872,000, that becomes a part of the budget from this time moving forward. So this is not a one-time ask. This is a continuing part of the budget if it were approved moving forward, correct?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, you are correct. However, we will see a savings of almost $1 million after FY21.
Okay. Follow up?
Follow up.
And those seven positions that will be added as a part of this, is that on top of the positions that will be moved if this, well, I'll be specific, be moved from Ketchikan and other locations to the Emergency Communications Center? In other words, there's going to be a move, I think, of seven positions from Ketchikan. So are these seven positions then on top of that?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, you are correct. The total number of dispatch positions needed to staff the Emergency Operations Center is 18. We are only moving positions from Ketchikan. We are not moving positions from any other facility. Those seven PCNs that the department has the resource and owns the staffing for will be moved, reallocated to provide statewide service that we believe to be more impactful to rural communities.
I don't know how I should feel about that, just only Ketchikan. But in any case.
Those are the only ones we own, sir.
Okay, so in essence, can you tell me a little bit more about this establishment of this Emergency Communications Center? Didn't it also include costs from previous years in the amount of $3.5 million?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, yes, sir. In FY19, under Governor Walker's administration, there was a capital appropriation of $3.5 million. It is that capital appropriation that is comprehensively paying for the upfit of the existing infrastructure that we have in Anchorage. There is no additional funding needed to build out that infrastructure. The only additional fund in order to staff up the program and improve the E911 compliance and provide 911 location services for rural Alaskans that don't have it is this request of seven permanent full-time positions.
And how much of that $3.5 million has already been expended?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, off the top of my head, sir, I don't have that exact figure, but I can certainly get it for you.
Well, rough estimate, more than 50%, less than 50%, that kind of thing?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, we are at what we call the 65% mark of the project in the engineering phase. So I would throw out 50%, but I'm happy to get you an exact dollar amount of what we've expended to date.
Follow up.
And as we move towards this project, and admittedly the project or the idea of the project started before you took the position that you're currently in. Was there a clear explanation at the time that this plan included the moving of positions and centralizing of operations in the Anchorage area?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, it is regular and common practice within this department and other departments to move resources to meet their statewide mission. So I don't believe at the time that the request for the capital appropriation was made under the prior administration that there was a clear explanation that the department was intending to close the dispatch facility. I do want to be clear that the closing of the dispatch facility is specific to the state dispatch facility that dispatches state resources. The Ketchikan arena still has a PSAP, a dispatch facility, and their own police department.
You mean, don't follow? You mean the city of Ketchikan?
City of Ketchikan, yes, sir.
Okay. I think that's it for now.
Representative Laban, did you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The $2.7 million on the supplemental budget. Do you roughly know how much that is divided between overtime and filling vacant positions, roughly?
Representative Laban, through the chair, the majority of it is overtime, and I can get that, but the majority of it is overtime related. It's that 26% increase that we saw in that year.
And a follow-up. Can I connect the dots with filling vacant trooper positions that you're doing a great job of pursuing that goal. Will the overtime number per trooper decline as these positions are filled, or is overtime with troopers just part of the normalcy of carrying out their duties?
Representative Laban, through the chair, the amount of overtime that this state is expecting the Alaska State Troopers to perform has a significant impact on this department's ability to retain the talented men and women who are serving. It is not a, quote, normal component of serving in a law enforcement capacity. Overtime is expected. 800 to 900 hours of overtime is not expected. The the question that you posed, you actually had posed to me in a subcommittee, so I actually do have a somewhat of a statistical analysis to throw out. There was a B detachment, which is our Matsu Borough detachment, staffing assessment completed in 2017. Arguably, it could be perceived to be outdated at this point because the population has grown significantly since then. That study reflected that we were woefully understaffed to perform minimum services at a minimum level of safety for troopers and the community. But that study did reflect that if we were to meet minimum staffing levels, our overtime costs would decrease by approximately 30%.
Thank you.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I apologize for getting here late. I didn't know the committee, and I probably missed out on a lot. So if you repeat yourself, forgive me. But you're right on the sheet that has some interest, and I'm going to go to the very top bullet, improving building plan review. I think that's the fire marshal's department there, and I know we've had the last couple years. Well, I think we've hired a new fire marshal in the last year or so, have we not? Did we not have one retire?
Representative Kopp, through the chair, we had our fire marshal, Dave Tyler, retired, and we brought Rich Boothby on as our state fire marshal.
So I'm glad to see that one because I've had a lot of calls in our ability to review them and really impacting the construction season, waiting on review, plan review stuff. So happy to see that one. Through the chair, the last bullet point, I guess, is one that obviously, so I thought I just heard you tell Rep Ortiz that you don't plan on closing or moving personnel. Was that in regards to the dispatch center? So the intent's not to move the dispatchers that the state employs from Soldotna and Matsu to Anchorage?
Representative Knopp, through the chair, we do not have state employees. We contract those facilities, so those employees belong to MATCOM and Soldotna, not to the state. We will be realigning our contract, but we do not have any positions to close or move from those facilities.
Okay. So then the other thing, follow-up, Madam Chair. So I mean, obviously, the last bullet point was a really a point of contention last year, and we had a long-time dispatch supervisor down there who said it's simply not going to do what they want it to do. And so we debated that a lot last year. And so I guess my question is, really, what are we wanting it to do? Is it efficiencies? At that time, there was some conversation about rural communities not being able to reach 911, and then other conversations went, even if they could reach 911, we still can't respond or get there or assist in that regard. So have we solved any of them issues, or where are we at with that?
Representative Knopp, through the chair, thank you for the question. This is, I wish we had actually more time just on this issue. I know it can be, it is a large project, and it's a multi-year project with significant scope of impact to our state. When I was appointed, this project had already received a capital appropriation. However, I think the first week that I was here, I sat around with my team and did not at the time feel as if the department had adequately vetted potential options aside from building a new facility with infrastructure we already have. We paused the project for 1 year. We engaged in what I would evaluate to be exhaustive conversations with the partners that we have contract services with, Soldotna and MATCOM. And based on those conversations and where each party was able to meet at, we could not find another mechanism to allow for the department to accomplish the goals of increasing and providing E911 services, E911 phase two compliance services throughout the state of Alaska, services that 20% of our residents don't currently have, to include location. So in certain communities, if you call 911, the first words out of your mouth have to be where you are. Otherwise, if you're disconnected, we have no idea. This will accomplish that. There are many, many technical aspects of why an emergency communication center does meet the needs. And yes, all of the technological hurdles that were introduced last year have been vetted. We have solid solutions in place, and we are very confident with the plan and the expertise that we have on this project that it will meet every goal that we have identified.
I hope it works as well as your confidence in it, in the project. So, and then the last thing, it's not on this sheet, and you may have touched on it already, but I need to ask you about the fire safety labor standard council, like your police standard council. Mm-hmm. So we lost some funding for that. You've consolidated a position. They've lost a position. And I understand they get a little overwhelmed with certifying. So can you help me what your plan is for that? And would, if you had additional funding, would the position be reinstated? Would they get back up to where they need to be? Or
Representative Knopp, through the chair, the Fire Standards Council establishes professional standards for the fire service personnel and curriculum requirements for the certification of training programs. We are very short-staffed. That is an area that we are challenged with. The internal challenge for the department is the lack of statutory requirement to provide a service, which then relates to if we don't have statutory requirement to provide a service and we're tight with our budget, do we funnel money to meet our statutory requirements, or do we funnel money in an arena that we all believe to be the right thing to do, which is providing necessary training for our fire service personnel throughout our state? But with money being as tight as it is, not being statutorily required to do so, that is the area that's sort of fallen off. I would very much like to see that reversed. We don't have an ask in this budget. One of the things that I'm hoping, and I probably should have brought our fire marshal up here to address this, but as we've addressed the fire and life safety building plan review turnaround time component, we have also, aside from this ask, made significant changes to our internal structure relating to plan review. Things like building a portal so that instead of mailing paper applications back and forth and checks back and forth, which can take weeks and weeks, having buildings that are asking for a plan review simply be able to go online, enter their information, and then pay by credit card. This will dramatically speed up our process. I am wondering, and I don't have a firm plan for FY21 for this, but at some point with the changes that we're making internally, I assume that the department will come and ask for supplement funding to stand up the Fire Standards Council. I also believe there's statutory gaps associated with what the obligation for the state is.
One follow-up.
Follow-up.
And so I'm going to ask you a question, and I don't want you to reply today, but at some point in the future, I want you to follow up with me on it. And so since you don't have a statutory requirement for the Standards Council for fire departments, would it be better served under a different department? I mean, is that something you have an interest in? So say you put the building inspectors, the fire marshal's office, and the fire chief, together, say they fell under deed or some other. I don't want you to answer that question. I just want you to give it food for thought and maybe sometime reach back out and let me know what your thoughts are on that, if you would.
Representative Knopp, through the chair, I can't answer that question right now. No, I do not believe the state would be best served to move those faculties to a different department. I do believe that, again, there's some statutory gaps that we need to address as a state. Do we believe that there's minimum certification requirements for firefighters in our state? We need to address that as a state. Lawmakers could address that. And then how would we fund and provide that training would be the next step. I would be very happy to engage in those conversations.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the item at the bottom of the page there, what kind of studies were done or what kind of investigative work was done to determine that the consolidation of service in the Anchorage area was and needing to revamp that existing facility to the tune of $3.5 million. Was that looked at carefully in comparison to other options that you might have had, for example, revamping the facility in Ketchikan?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, the answer is yes, sir. There were a number of studies that have been completed, and I'm happy to provide those, sir. One of those studies included a site assessment of the Ketchikan facility itself in 2006. We have two nationally renowned experts who build out emergency communication centers in the Pacific Northwest. This is what they do, and they have brought their breadth of experience to this department. The short answer, sir, is that the Ketchikan facility does not have the built-in infrastructure to carry the call volume that is necessary for an emergency operations center to respond to the level of calls that we anticipate this facility to receive.
Follow up.
And before the $3.5 million that are starting to go forward towards the Anchorage facility, that also didn't have the capability as well. Is that correct?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, it's difficult for me to answer questions about how the project was communicated and prepped for before. All I know is that when I stepped in, this is information that we uncovered and are sharing at this point.
Follow up?
And you're saying that you referred to a study as far back as 2006. So evidently, the department was looking at this idea as much as 13 years ago, 14 years ago. Is that correct?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, I think it's fair to say that as technology advances, the department consistently assesses what is available to us to improve every avenue of providing improved service for Alaskans.
Okay. Follow up.
And
so if it's been in the minds of the department for 13 to 14 years, doesn't it seem kind of strange that the first time I heard about this idea of consolidating services, me being a representative of the district that's being highly impacted, the first time I heard of that was in after the new year of this year?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, I don't know if I can speak to whether it's strange or not. We might have different definitions of that. I do not believe that it is strange, sir. I believe that this department made a decision with existing resources that have been appropriated to this department to meet the mission that we are statutory obligated to provide to Alaskan citizens.
Representative Laban.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I know the commissioner is aware that we've spent a little bit of time talking about the Civil Air Patrol. And I guess this is half comment, half question, but I guess I had a wish, a hope, that we would see this budget rollout room for a couple hundred thousand dollars for the Civil Air Patrol. The budget difference from fiscal year 2019 to fiscal year 2021 is an increase of about $20 million. And we haven't seen money in for the Civil Air Patrol for the last two budget years. So I guess if you wish to weigh in on this at any level, I know building that budget is not entirely your call, but I wish we could find some room for the Civil Air Patrol. And if you wish to make a comment.
Representative Laban, through the chair, thank you for the question. This is one of those really challenging topics. There are many exceptional services available in our state that I know that we all wish that we could fund and provide. The short answer, sir, is there's some historical perspective associated with legislative intent from a different legislature that included removing the Civil Air Patrol funding from the department's budget 2 years ago, giving them a one-time increment and direction to find alternate funding sources. The governor's FY20 budget, which eliminated the Civil Air Patrol appropriation, did follow through with the prior legislator's legislation's intent. The Civil Air Patrol is a pass-through for the Department of Public Safety. My perspective, being accountable to the fiscal resources that are appropriated from the lawmakers to my department, is that it is not mission critical for this department. And while it is a valuable and critical service for this department is obligated to provide that service, and we do not find a discernible impact to removing the funding of Civil Air Patrol, though we support them in every way that we can.
Follow up?
As a follow-up, I guess we will agree to disagree. I think it is a significantly critical component to your total mission, in my opinion. Thank you.
And in follow-up to that, in the back of my mind, I thought a number of the planes left once there wasn't any funding. Are you aware of, like, the Beavers, I think, were gone?
Madam Chair, for the Civil Air Patrol or for my fleet?
No, Civil Air Patrol.
Oh, I can't speak to that, ma'am.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, of course, I want to talk about the Emergency Communications Center with regard to how it will work with MATCOM. Mm-hmm. It is quite a concern for the city of Wasilla to see how we will move forward with regard to communications. I know our MATCOM system has been very efficient, very effective, and especially for the area of not just Wasilla, but of course all across the Mat-Su Valley and then some. Can you give us a little more detail on how you are working then as a centralized unit to include MATCOM in Wasilla and then even in the peninsula area? What is the plan?
Representative Sullivan Leonard, through the chair, thank you for your question. And the reason that we paused for one year was to give a significant amount of consideration to our partner at MATCOM and in Soldotna. We engaged in significant conversations in writing back and forth with MATCOM. Our plan A was to avoid building a structure in Anchorage. Our plan A was to amend our contract with MATCOM with an ownership opportunity, which we had to have per FCC regulations, and the city of Wasilla declined to enter into that partnership with us. So our plan B is where we are now, which allows for us to accomplish the goal of improving the service to rural communities. It really, other than the contractual impact to MATCOM, they will continue operating in the manner with which they operate, and they will continue transferring calls in the manner that they transfer calls.
Okay, follow up, Madam Chair?
Follow up.
So my next question then is with regard to the detail of the communications itself. So, for example, if I'm making a 911 call from Wasilla, it still goes through MATCOM, or is it going to go to the communications center in Anchorage?
Representative Sullivan Leonard, through the chair, I'm going to allow Captain Rick Roberts to answer your question. Captain? Maybe I'm not.
Good afternoon. Through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, the answer to your question is there are primary areas that receive 911 calls or that all 911 calls in that primary geographic area then get routed to a specific point. Those are called PSAPs. And the PSAP for the Mat-Su borough is right now assigned to the Wasilla, the city of Wasilla's communication center. On the Kenai Peninsula, the Kenai Peninsula borough PSAP is the Kenai Borough Dispatch Center. So all 911 calls in those regions will be funneled to that 911 center. They will answer the call, and then based on the initial information they receive from the caller, they then transfer that call to the appropriate department. For instance, in the Mat-Su borough, that call will, all calls will come in to that 911 center. If it's a fire-related call, then they'll hand it to a fire-related dispatcher. If it's a trooper-related call, then they would send it to this Anchorage Dispatch Center or Operations Center we're creating. The same thing occurs on the Kenai Peninsula now, where all 911 calls on the peninsula, if you call from Homer, it routes through the Kenai Borough Dispatch Center, and then the Kenai Borough then transfers it to the Homer Police or Homer Fire Department to respond to your call, or a state trooper dispatcher if you're in their area.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Follow up.
And thank you for that information. And just to follow up on that for another question is, so if I'm making a phone call, E911, and it is where I'm out in a rural area of Mat-Su, is that going then to the Anchorage Center? And then am I competing then with a call that could be on track from ANIAC?
Representative Sullivan Leonard, through the chair, no. We have two dispatch facilities, one in Fairbanks. We're basically cutting the state in half. We have redundancy of service. So the Fairbanks dispatch facility will cover the northern part of the state in very broad terms, and the Anchorage, the southern part of the state. The reason for the redundancy is in the event of a natural disaster, an earthquake, and for if some reason our service were to go out, we have that redundancy in Fairbanks and in Anchorage.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure you've thought through this. Where does the priority lie when you've got a fire and police issue? If they have, if the local dispatcher has to make a decision between calling the troopers or calling the firemen, which one gets the call if it impacts both?
Commissioner, I don't know if I'm the one to answer that question. I don't know if we have anybody online that maybe that's more of a dispatch related question, of which I'm not an expert.
So. Representative Carpenter, through the chair, I understand what your question is, but I believe that it's really situation dependent. The dispatcher is going to seek and secure additional information about the about what is happening in the incident in question, and then make the call based on what they determine the priority to be. Whether it's an emergency communication center in Anchorage, one in Ketchikan, one in Akiak, that none of that doesn't get solved by this. A dispatcher still making the call in every incident.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The situation as I see it, though, is that the call is already transferred by the time the situation develops. So if the local dispatcher makes a call and makes a decision and transfers that call one direction, and then the situation develops, we now have to start the process over again to get rerouted to the correct. See, it already went to the fire. Now it's got to come back to another call to go back to the police. Whereas if it was a local dispatcher, they would have the authority to be able to answer both those issues right then without having to transfer it to somewhere else.
Representative Carpenter, through the chair, I understand now what you're suggesting. I believe that your understanding of the manner with which the emergency operations communication center will be able to dispatch is slightly off, so I'll ask Captain Roberts to speak to that.
Representative Carpenter, through the chair, it's Captain Roberts. So there are policies already outlined in dispatch centers to help dispatchers decide where that call should go based on the priority level. In the city of Anchorage right now, there's a fire dispatch center and a police dispatch center, and those types of calls that you're describing actually occur every day all over Alaska and the United States, and our dispatchers are trained to be able to work together so that we reduce the amount of time it takes for us to get the right resources to the place that people need them. This kind of call routing, because I'm not a dispatcher, I get to do what they direct. I don't understand some of the nuances about how those decisions are made, but I do know that there are comprehensive outlines and policies to help move those calls quickly so that there isn't a delay. And this is already occurring all over the place, like I said, in the city of Anchorage, where we have different dispatch centers for the different types of services that are provided.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With all due respect, if it's already occurring in Anchorage, that's great. The people live in Anchorage. We live on the Kenai, and now the calls are going to be routed to Anchorage. It's apples and oranges.
Representative Carpenter, through the chair, I can get you a written explanation that's specific to your question. My understanding, sir, is we are not making any change to the dispatch facility in Soldotna outside of our contract that we have for how they dispatch troopers. They will still be receiving calls and providing dispatch services to your local area.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you. So I'm off dispatcher, you know. But I do want to mention a couple things. First, to the co-chair of finance, Civil Air Patrol still has lots of airplanes. The only thing Civil Air Patrol got rid of was the Beavers. I was a member of Civil Air Patrol for maybe not quite 20 years, but a long time. And also one of the flight instructors did check rides for numerous members of different squadrons when they didn't have an instructor for check rides. So they still have a lot of 172s, 206s, 182s. Not sure if they have any 185s left or not. Most of them were equipped with wheels and floats at the time. The Beavers were and the 185s were. I'm not sure what they have that's ski equipped any longer, but still numerous airplanes is the point. And Civil Air Patrol had two primary purposes, and that was disaster relief and search and rescue, more search and rescue, but we kind of left that up to troopers and military, but search was a big component. You know, in my squadron, it takes about $10,000 a year just to keep the doors open. It's been a struggle the last couple of years because the funding has been slashed and nothing. So they are an important component of our system because troopers don't always have them resources to get out there and start searching. And in general aviation, is a completely different animal than what than a commercial or, you know, something else is. So on that point, it's a little bothersome, Commissioner, when it's not a priority for your department. You know, and you earlier mentioned about a statutory requirement in the Fire Standard Council. You know, it's not no statutory requirement, so it falls off your priority list, but it's important to some of us, you know, and that was the crutch of my question. The dispatch center, obviously you don't have state employees, but you have contract employees, and them contract employees will go away because you'll quit funding them down there, you know, so, but just the same dispatch center has to be manned around the clock. As you know, so, and I can't imagine that you would like statutory requirements in every single thing you do to make it a priority, you know. So, I guess it's not really a question, but I'd hope you'd reconsider what I'm saying. It is important to a lot of us, that's why it's out there, you know. And so, somehow, if you have a suggestion to make it a priority, something we can help other than funding, Let us know, please.
Madam Chair, may I respond briefly? Representative Knopp, through the chair, thank you for your observations. I do want to put forward, this is one of those sticky situations, Civil Air Patrol, because we are partners with the Civil Air Patrol. One of the manners with which this department has attempted to partner more significantly with the Civil Air Patrol is we increase the payment amount that we appropriate for their utilities in the Fairbanks hangar from 25% to 50%. We cover the snow removal. We are trying to figure out ways that we can support them. The reason that we don't have it in our budget request is very, very simple. The things that we are asking for, we deem to be critically important to preserving life and property, and we aren't certain that we're going to get the funding that we are requesting. So asking for funding that would be lovely to have. I wish that I could feel confident asking for that funding, and I would love to stand here and be a strong advocate for Civil Air Patrol and request funding. I just can't in responsibility to the duties that I hold.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to dispatch services, I have one question about you mentioned earlier, after I had asked you some questions, I believe it was to Representative Sullivan Leonard, that you had a plan A, and a plan A included continuing services or continuing to contract services with MATCOM. Is that correct?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, it was a more comprehensive plan, but that was the largest component of our ability to move forward with Plan A, yes.
Okay. And when Plan A, when you determined that Plan A couldn't be executed because you couldn't come to agreement with MATCOM, did that have any impact on the decision as to what you were going to do with the dispatchers in Ketchikan?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, that's a really good question, sir. I will go back and look at our letters and the breakdown. My understanding, sir, is that even if we went with Plan A, we would have expanded the service and built out essentially the facility that we're building out now with the capabilities that we're building out now in partnership with MATCOM, and we would still have needed the positions from Ketchikan to do so. But I will get you information further to answer that.
And final follow-up? I promise, final follow-up, at least for now. Getting back to Representative Carpenter's question about the effectiveness of dispatch, isn't there going to be some opportunity cost in effectiveness of dispatch when up to now with dispatch happening in places like Ketchikan with dispatchers who have knowledge of the areas surrounding Ketchikan and the community surrounding Ketchikan, when a call comes in and somebody says, you know, I need help at such and such street. In Ketchikan, those people likely know whether that's a boardwalk street, where the location is, those kinds of things, versus in Anchorage, isn't there going to be some opportunity cost in terms of knowledge of area and knowledge of dispatch, the dispatch that's happening?
Representative Ortiz, through the chair, another great question, sir. Based on the historical fact that the Fairbanks dispatch facility has been comprehensively providing dispatch services to Ketchikan during evening hours every day, we believe that we're fully capable of covering all the needs.
Follow-up?
So under the plan, I'm sorry. So under the plan, the dispatch is going to happen out of Fairbanks rather than Anchorage?
No, sir. Representative Ortiz, through the chair, what I'm stating is that for quite some time, the Fairbanks Center has provided dispatch services to Ketchikan every evening during a specified window. So we will now just be providing that service from Anchorage. The history reflects to us that we certainly have the capability of doing so effectively because we have been doing it for quite some time.
Representative LeBond?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, Fairbanks is happy to help Ketchikan in this manner. The bullet under increased operational capacity, you have that tug of war between rural and urban. Trooper assignments, how many in urban communities, how many in rural communities? I know part of your operational capacity funding increase is for trooper positions in the rural community. Do you want to update the committee on where this is? This has been a topic in our subcommittee level quite a bit, so I'm giving you a chance to talk a little bit about that.
Representative Lebon, through the chair. Thank you, sir. Yes, our primary priority at this point is to expand the trooper ranks within rural communities. The 15 additional positions that we are asking for that I am 100% confident we are filling will be placed in Ambler, Anchor Point, Bethel, Dillingham, Ammonick, Glen Allen, Kotzebue, Nome, St. Mary's, St. Michael, and Unalakleet. We also have additional positions, civilian support staff positions, Juneau, Kotzebue, Dillingham, Kodiak. We have a pilot position going to Nome. That being said, sir, it is a very difficult decision because my, quote, urban posts, which cover vast geographic territory, Mat-Su specific is an example of the vast geographic territory that those troopers cover, are dramatically understaffed. And in fact, the only staffing study that the state has ever activated was completed in B detachment, and it tells us without question that the B detachment trooper post does not meet minimum standards for trooper safety or citizen safety. So it's very, very difficult to make the call on where we're placing resources, but we at this point are placing them in rural communities.
Follow-up?
As a follow-up, would you then say that the Kenai and the Fairbanks boroughs are adequately staffed, or do they suffer the same condition?
Representative Lebon, through the chair, I would be remiss to say that anywhere in our state is adequately staffed with law enforcement.
Representative Foster?
The Unalakleet position, there's been one position there, so this would be adding one, and you would therefore have two. It's not that the one person who's there is retiring. There would actually be two there, correct?
Mr. Chairman, you are correct. These are additional positions at these post locations in addition to the existing staff.
Thank you.
Just a quick follow-up for future planning on this. With the large boroughs that do have a taxing population, we looked into a couple years ago for our Girdwood, which is within the municipality of Anchorage, to have a policing service area. And one of the choices they had that we actually negotiated was to have them pay the cost of the state troopers. So it was a hybrid, because one of the problems between a city police and the troopers is the troopers are more of a rural unit as opposed to an urban unit. And so sometimes it's just as appropriate for the troopers to be there, but then there is a taxing base. So as you're talking to communities, it might be something you suggest. I do have one question. Almar, I understand, and it's now out of the Department of Administration. It's going to the Department of Military Affairs, but you are one of the largest users of it. And I understand that there might be a need for an upgrade that is much more than what's in the budget. Do you want to weigh in on that?
Representative Johnston, Madam Chair, I do have the information. I'm struggling to determine if I should answer it because, again, it's not within the purview of my department, but I'm happy at your request to provide it. There is a requirement for $24 million to upgrade the infrastructure. It's replacing repeaters throughout the state. There is no other manner by which the state can move forward. If we do not do that by July, the Department of Defense will pull out, build their own infrastructure. The cost will be immeasurable and the impact significant. We do have alternatives. That's why you don't see a request in the governor's budget. We are vetting two very strong alternatives on how we can fund that project outside of asking for a supplemental or capital request.
Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing none, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next significant operating budget change reflects $1 million in additional federal receipt authority to go to the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. Just of note, this is something that the department's very, very proud of, and I think is an area that sometimes gets overlooked. We have in the room our Executive Director, Diane Casto. She and her staff work so closely and so hard with 26 primarily rural emergency shelter programs and victim service agencies, and their division has been able to push out more money, has secured more federal dollars to match state dollars than ever in the history of our state. They've also just recently released the award notifications to many rural communities with a funding stream that has never before been presented. One such funding stream supports child advocacy centers, which allows for comprehensive services to be provided to a child who's experienced trauma and their families, as well as additional and enhanced mental health services to survivors. This is just a side note that I wanted to share with the committee, that $1 million is in federal receipt authority as it relates to our ability to access FOCA funds. The next is increasing our crime lab capacity. We are asking for statewide support and laboratory services for $744,000 and 4 permanent full-time positions. The primary intent is to reduce the turnaround time. I'm happy to talk specifically about sexual assault kits, but just as a note for the committee that this is comprehensive of all forensic evidence and other processes that the crime lab must handle. These 4 positions will allow for any backlog that comes in or any evidence that comes in to be processed in a much more timely manner. And as it relates to sexual assault kits, I'm of course very happy to answer any questions that anyone might have about that project.
I don't see any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, that is all, and I'm certainly here for any more questions about dispatch.
I don't
Okay, I don't see any further questions. Thank you very much for your presentation today.
Thank you, members of the committee.
So our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, February 7th at 1:30 p.m., and at that meeting we will hear a budget overview presentation from the Department of Fish and Game, and we will bring back SB 74 before the committee. Very quickly, SB 74, Ryan, do you know what that is? That is which one? E-rate? That's the broadband. Okay. With that, we'll be adjourned at 3:29 p.m.